Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who is to blame for the legions of miscalculations and failures in America's Afghanistan war, and what makes this country such an inhospitable place for both war and peace? The bombing campaign begun in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks has stretched into the longest war in American history and does not seem to have been much improved by the Obama administration's authorization of a two-year surge in 2009. Joining us to talk about the state of Afghanistan today and about the little-known history of American involvement there long before 9/11 is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris. Good to talk to you.
If one theme unites every anecdote, every bit of analysis in this book, it is that there is no single actor to blame for the mess that the U.S. campaign has been in Afghanistan. There have been multiple misjudgments, multiple miscalculations along the way.
Indeed. You know, in some ways, it began with the previous administration taking its eye off the ball in Afghanistan to focus on the invasion of Iraq at a time when building a reasonably stable state with a basic government and some basic security forces would not have been all that difficult. But by the time we get to 2009 and a new occupant in the White House with a new desire to try to turn around the failing war and the growing instability in Afghanistan and tries to turn it around with more troops, more civilian personnel, diplomats and reconstruction workers, and billions more dollars in reconstruction assistance, that effort is also bedeviled with all sorts of problems. Yes, I mean, the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan, it's sad to say, has been a story of great American missteps in many different directions, save for the real direction in terms of trying to achieve some sort of lasting stability.
So President Obama comes into office in 2009 and essentially has two choices for Afghanistan. He can go with counterinsurgency or he can go with counterterrorism. For people who don't follow this as closely as you do, can you explain the difference between the two?
Of course. So counterterrorism is sort of a narrower military strategy. It says you employ your forces to go after and kill or capture the real bad guys, the terrorist leaders. You try to decapitate the insurgency. It involves a small number of more elite special forces to do that sort of work. Counterinsurgency is a much broader strategy. It says instead of focusing on the bad guys and trying to kill them, the way you attack an insurgency is actually to place your forces in and around the civilian population. You protect the good people instead of chasing the bad guys. And the idea is that by protecting the good people, you deprive the insurgency of the popular support it needs to sustain itself. And eventually, the insurgency dwindles to a smaller number of people who you can either capture or who will surrender. Counterinsurgency strategy is what was employed to a degree in Iraq during the troop surge there. Instead of focusing in on trying to kill lots of people, although we did that as well, we used a lot of our troops in Baghdad to try to protect civilian populations. So when Obama took office, military commanders said, if you want to turn around the situation in Afghanistan, we need to do what we did in Iraq, which is counterinsurgency. Oh, by the way, it will involve a lot of troops, a lot of money, and a substantial amount of time. But the military said, this is pretty much the only strategy. There was a healthy debate in the White House in 2009. A number of the president's civilian advisors didn't buy it. They questioned whether COIN would simply too expensive, too time-consuming, and favored a narrower counterterrorism type approach. The chief proponent of the counterterrorism model was Vice President Biden. But at the end of the day, as we all know so well, that counterinsurgency strategy won out, and to resource that strategy, the president had to sign off on thousands more troops to go to the country.
Rajiv, is there something special about Afghanistan that makes it harder than any other foreign country for outsiders to truly understand and appropriately manage?
Well, you know, Afghanistan is commonly referred to as the graveyard of empires, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the British were there for decades and ultimately failed to really pacify the country and had to leave with tail between the legs. The Soviets, as we know so well, were there in the 1980s and were ultimately defeated by the CIA-backed Mujahideen. And so there's this narrative out there that Afghanistan is sort of unconquerable with its rugged terrain, its landlocked, fearsome fighters whose skills have been honed fighting invaders over the centuries. And all of that is true. But it doesn't mean that Afghanistan has to be simply resigned or written off as a completely lawless place. There are things the international community can do to help the country, but we have to be mindful of the fact that not only are the Afghans fearsome fighters, but that it's like going back in time when you go there. I mean, some parts of the country still feel like it's trapped in the 13th century. Illiteracy is rampant. You know, in parts of southern Afghanistan where I traveled, simply having a pen in your shirt pocket is seen as a sign of social status because 90% of the men are illiterate and 99% of the women are. And so when you think about how are you going to build a new government? How are you going to build security forces and a police force with people who can't read and write? It has to lead you toward more modest initiatives. And unfortunately, we sought to downplay a lot of these very real challenges and said, we're Americans. We've got a can-do spirit. We've got lots of resources. We can succeed where these other empires have failed if we're just smarter and we throw more money at it. And I think we were smarter, but there are these sort of entrenched factors that just make it very difficult. And we have to be realistic about how much we can expect to change in a short period of time.
And it turns out we have a sort of history with this kind of hubris with regard to Afghanistan, and it's not a story that's been much told. It refers back to the title of your book, Little America. After World War II, there was, in fact, a pretty significant U.S. effort to remake at least the agriculture industry in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's this remarkable history that surprised me as I stumbled upon it, because we all think that our engagement there began either with 9/11 or when the Soviets invaded in the 1980s. But actually, starting in the late 1940s, dozens and dozens of American engineers went to southern Afghanistan to construct a network of irrigation canals and dams in an effort to try to turn a swath of barren desert into a verdant agricultural oasis, to create a breadbasket of sorts for Afghanistan to allow it to feed itself. And this was part of a vast nation-building effort that initially was paid for by the Afghans themselves. The Afghan had money in their treasury back in the 1940s. This project was unfortunately hobbled by a number of mistakes by both the Afghans and the Americans. Proper studies weren't done in terms of looking at the soil and the drainage conditions, and so the hopes for this real swath of farmland, sort of like the Central Valley of California, really failed to materialize. And there were then multiple efforts by the U.S. government to step in and try to fix this problem, soon funded by U.S. taxpayers, because we were worried in the 1960s that if we didn't fix this, the Soviets would encroach from the north and try to get a foothold down there and take ownership of this. But it was something that consumed lots of American development dollars, a lot of American attention in the 50s and 60s. And had we bothered to go back and look at this little history, it would have been very instructive in perhaps cautioning us and warning us away from trying to do too much nation building in these more recent years. And the title of the book, I should note, comes from another part of this project. In addition to trying to build farmland, the American engineers decided to set up a town for themselves where they would live, but they also thought the Afghans would look at and aspire to sort of recreate for themselves in other parts of the country. And so we set up an 8-square-block enclave with American-style white stucco homes with nicely manicured green front lawns. It had the country's first and only co-ed swimming swimming pool, a high school where boys and girls studied together, and a clubhouse where you could get a gin and tonic. There were nightly card games, weekly square dances. It was a little bit of Americana dropped into the Afghan desert. And the Afghans looked at this place and said, you know, that's fine for you Americans, but we don't really want it for ourselves. But they started to call it Little America.
And from the very beginning, one of the reasons things failed is because American contractors burned through every last penny that had been set aside for this.
Yes. You know, we like to think that excesses by contractors are a modern phenomenon, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan. But the American contractor who was hired by the Afghans with the Afghans' own money insisted that every piece of equipment to dig the canals and build the dams had to be transported from America. And before long, the Afghan treasury was depleted. They just completely fleeced the Afghans, essentially forcing then the U.S. government to come in first with loans and then with outright financial assistance to prevent the project from becoming totally stalled.
How did the start of the Iraq War really change the nature of the focus on Afghanistan and the success of the effort in Afghanistan?
It deprived the effort of attention, of resources. We totally took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan to focus on Iraq. Troops were pulled out. Civilian diplomats and reconstruction workers were pulled out. Reconstruction budgets were trimmed. Important other assets like intelligence collection tools were all diverted from Afghanistan to Iraq. And it fundamentally hobbled the effort to try to build a stable Afghanistan. Had we not done that, had we not gone into Iraq and focused a reasonable degree of resources on Afghanistan, we would be in a much, much better position today. I wouldn't have written this book. We wouldn't be wringing our hands about this. Afghanistan probably would not be the longest war in American history. We probably wouldn't have more than 2,000 dead service members there. It would have turned out very, very differently. I'm not trying to say it would be ideal. You probably still have a corrupt, inefficient government. You might have pockets of insurgency, but nowhere near the mess we have there today.
Now, along the way, the U.S. also had to manage relationships with its foreign allies. It had Canada, it had Britain. And it seems that in many cases, protocol sort of got in the way of pragmatic strategy.
Yes. And this is something that I didn't really expect until I got out to Afghanistan, repeated trips, and started watching how we were fighting with our NATO allies. You know, this is the first real joint NATO nation-building mission in NATO's history. It was a real test to see whether the alliance could fight together in a far-off foreign land. But what really has happened is that instead of fighting as a unified force, the NATO member states have sort of fought as their own individual fiefdoms. And many of the NATO members have come in with their own sets of rules and restrictions. Now, Germans only want to be in a certain part of the country. The Spanish and the Italians will do certain things but not others. And in the South, which is of now great importance to the United States, prior to our troop surge, it had largely been the domain of the British and the Canadians. And they just didn't have enough force on the ground to do what was necessary. And in many cases, they weren't operating the same way we were. And as we came in, instead of working closely together, all sorts of new frictions emerged.
My guest is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He's senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Rajiv Chandrasekaran is my guest. He is senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit, Rajiv, about a conflict among the different branches of the U.S. military. Not only were there questions about who would handle what, but in what territory they would be stationed. And this seems to have been an issue, particularly in terms of the placement of U.S. Marines.
Chris, this is a remarkable story. When President Obama signed off on the first tranche of additional troops to go to Afghanistan in early 2009, the majority of those forces actually wound up going to a part of Helmand Province that was home to fewer than 1% of Afghanistan's population, instead of going to the areas in and around Kandahar, the country's second largest city, the real spiritual homeland for the Taliban. The city that if the Taliban had captured, they would have had a springboard to take over much of the rest of the country like they did in the 1990s. So why weren't they sent to Kandahar, particularly if the strategy was supposed to be counterinsurgency, was supposed to be protecting the people? Why didn't they go to the most important part of the country to beat back the Taliban and instead went to a patch of desert that was home to relatively few people? The answers I discovered and I write about in the book had to do with tribal rivalries, not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. The U.S. Marine Corps, which made up the majority of that first wave of forces, did not want to fight side by side with the U.S. or Canadian armies. They wanted to bring their own helicopters, their own logistics convoys, and they wanted to have their own, essentially their own corner of the sandbox. They wanted their own area in which to operate. And so Kandahar could not be carved out in such a way to give the Marines their own space. So they were sent to a relatively unimportant part of the country. And we really wound up squandering a year of the troop surge. Instead of taking those Marines, which was a fairly elite unit, they were great fighters, and putting them against the hardest problem set, the most dire areas, we wound up just having them often in parts of the desert that weren't really home to a whole lot of people.
So there was a great deal of violence in the places they were going. They just didn't necessarily achieve anything strategic by being there.
Yes. I mean, they're places. Pretty much anywhere you go in Afghanistan, if you're Western military forces, there will be bad guys to kill. And there were places they could go and rebuild and conduct their operations. But in the zero-sum game of how you allocate your forces in a vast country with lots of different problem spots, it wasn't the most important place. And we wound up really not getting the maximum benefit in a strategic level. Sure, the areas they went, they did great things. But did that have an aggregate impact in terms of increasing the overall stability of the country? And I think the answer to that is no.
Given some of the failures of international cooperation, I suppose it makes a sort of sense that the Marines were reluctant to work directly with the Canadians or the British. But it also appears that they weren't really interested in sharing territory with the U.S. Army.
Yeah, it's crazy, but it's true. I mean, and some of this goes back to actually World War II. During battles in the Pacific, the Marines felt they didn't get enough air cover from Navy aviators. So since then, they've insisted on deploying is what they call a Marine Air Ground Task Force, where they bring in their own helicopters and their own support units. And that means they need their own sort of airspace, their own territory that's sort of just for them. And we did that in Vietnam. We did that to a degree in Iraq. But the problem in Afghanistan was because they made up such a big part of the new forces coming in, they would wind up going to a place that just wasn't as essential. Whereas had they worked in partnership with the American Army in the areas around Kandahar, we could have potentially seen some more profound changes earlier on. Now, of course, there's a broader question here about whether the overall counterinsurgency strategy was wise or not. And I tackle that in the book. But if you accept that that was the strategy that the president signed off on and he approved those troops for a surge, then you have to sort of step back and say, how did the organs of his government, how did the Pentagon, the State Department, how did USAID, how did they go about implementing it? And as we've seen from the story about the Marines, and as I write about with the State Department and the Agency for International Development, the execution of the president's policy left an awful lot to be desired.
I want to talk in just a minute about the USAID question, but let's get back to this for a minute, Rajiv. With regard to this counterinsurgency, military commanders had asked for 40,000 troops. The president gave them 25% fewer than that. Is it reasonable to ask the question of whether or not the additional 10,000 might have made a better impression?
It's a reasonable question to ask. I think the record shows that if, yeah, maybe they gotten 10,000 more, they could have gone into a few more places. But it would not have addressed the fundamental problems with the counterinsurgency strategy. And let me just note a couple of them for you real briefly. The first is, for counterinsurgency to have worked, we needed a real partner in Afghanistan. We needed the Afghan government to be a partner, President Hamid Karzai and his administration. But Karzai didn't see the problem the way we did. He didn't think that American troops needed to be mucking around in the villages of southern Afghanistan. He wanted them all on the border with Pakistan. And so he was never a willing partner in our efforts. And that was a fundamental flaw in the strategy. Number two was that for counterinsurgency to have worked, the government in Pakistan needed to crack down on sanctuaries that the Taliban enjoyed along the border regions in Pakistan. The Pakistanis, however, as we know very well, really have failed to act on this front. And then counterinsurgency requires money, time, patience. Were we Americans, given the economic crisis we're in, willing to continue to want to spend, you know, about $100 billion a year? That's what it costs to keep 100,000 troops on the ground for a year in Afghanistan. Were we willing to do that for some years on end? Was Afghanistan really worth it? So the president gives the military 30 out of the 40,000 that they want. I'd argue that the bigger determinant here was the deadline. The president also, when he announced the surge, said that troops would begin coming back home by the summer of 2011, essentially said it was going to be a two-year surge. Well, that sent a message to everyone in Afghanistan that the American presence really wasn't going to be a long-term one. And it sent a message to the Taliban that if they just sort of waited out the Americans, that one day there would be far fewer Western troops on Afghan soil and they'd be able to make a real push for trying to retake the country. So if you look at it from the point of view of those who advocate a really robust counterinsurgency mission, their problem was less that he gave the military a few fewer troops than they wanted, but more about the date. But if you didn't put the date on it, would the U.S. be there in large numbers for 4, 5, 6 years longer? And at what cost? And was Afghanistan really worth all those many billions of dollars and those many lives? And that really came to, you know, the real crux of the debate. And the president was sort of caught between these two forces, between a military that wanted a robust counterinsurgency mission and his civilian advisors who were very skeptical of it. And the president tried to sort of split the difference. And I think by doing so, wound up not really pleasing either side in this and getting to a strategy that has accomplished something but really hasn't led to the profound changes that those who are counterinsurgency proponents had promised in their arguments to the president back in 2009.
To what extent do you think the 2011 pullout date was about domestic electoral politics?
I think it had something to do with it. The president certainly understood that many members of the Democratic Party were very skeptical of a troop surge, and he was trying to assure them that he wasn't going to greenlight an open-ended war. There was also a view in the White House that if they put a deadline out there publicly, that it would compel the Afghans to try to do compel the Afghans to sort of step up quickly and increase the size of their army to really to move with greater alacrity to take responsibility. But it actually wound up having sort of the opposite impact. The Afghans saw the additional American forces as a crutch and said, well, why should we fight if you're going to be here? Others looked at it and said, well, okay, you're surging, but you're leaving. So why should we throw our support behind the Afghan government? Because soon enough, you're going to be gone from here. And then we're going to be forced to deal with a resurgent Taliban. And so it in many ways muted the impact of the additional forces that hit the ground.
Why have more than a decade of efforts to really bolster and strengthen and retrain the Afghan army fallen so short of goals?
That's a really good question, because the Afghans, as we know, are fearsome fighters. I mean, look at how they stood up to the Soviets in the 1980s. And you sort of wonder, why aren't they doing the same thing today? Well, it's in part because the Afghans aren't sure what they're fighting for. Many Afghans don't look at the government in Kabul and say that's a legitimate government. Many Afghans find themselves more allied to certain warlords or ethnic political factions in the country. We're trying to create this army out of whole cloth, this national army that represents different ethnicities, different regions, and trying to build it in sort of a Western model. You know, we're equipping them with U.S.-made M16 rifles as opposed to the AK-47 Kalashnikovs that they know well and know how to use. We're giving them U.S.-made Humvees as opposed to pickup trucks. And so we're trying to build an army in more of a Western model where they are used to fighting in slightly more primitive ragtag ways, but can be very effective when they're fighting in the ways they know how to fight. And so we see an army that doesn't feel like it's sort of a mature fighting force from our Western construct. But really, I think what's going on is that the Afghans say, why should we stick our neck out when you Americans are here doing the fighting? Soon enough, you will leave, and then we'll be forced to deal with some of this, but we'll also strike some deals, and we'll take care of this in an Afghan way. But for now, we sort of look at them and say, well, they're lazy, they're incompetent, they're just sitting back on bases. But they see this as completely rational. They're like, well, we'll sit back while you guys do the hard work.
This sense that so many of us have as Americans that what works for us should work brilliantly for everyone else in the world also extends to the way that we have applied foreign aid to Afghanistan. So on the one hand, we are fighting these battles and there are parts of the country being torn apart. And then we're trying to remake things. And once again, the issue of agriculture comes up. And USAID had some important choices to make here.
They did. And it was going to be a question of, well, how do we get the Afghans to stop growing poppies which are used to make opium and refined into heroin, mm-hmm. which helps to fund the insurgency? And what the Afghan farmers in many parts of southern Afghanistan wanted was help growing a crop that they had cultivated in the 60s and 70s, and a crop known well in Texas.
Cotton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a cash crop, and you know, Afghans grow a mixture of sort of wheat and corn to feed themselves, but they also need a cash crop to pay the bills, to pay the dowries for their daughters' weddings and such. Well, the U.S. government looked at all this and said, you guys want help with cotton? Well, guess what? We can't help you with that. Because of a 1986 law passed by then-Senator Dale Bumpers of Arkansas, designed to protect king cotton in the United States. Taxpayer dollars cannot be used to help another country's cotton industry. Well, look, the U.S. Agency for International Development could have gone to the White House and probably gotten a waiver because of the national security import. And besides, Afghan cotton was never going to compete with American cotton. But instead of trying to find an innovative solution to help Afghan farmers grow a crop they wanted to grow instead of poppy, we said no to them. And we came up with all sorts of other, cockamamie solutions, things like flying in Bolivians to teach them how to build cobblestone roads, which, of course, the Afghans had no desire to have cobblestone roads, or coming up with other sorts of employment schemes, short-term things like, oh, we'll pay you some money to clean out canals, as opposed to giving them meaningful assistance to grow other crops that would make them a real living as opposed to poppy. And we fumbled this again and again. We fumbled it for years. I mean, it's galling to me. It was messed up during the Bush administration. It continued to be messed up during the Obama administration. A real opportunity to help the Afghan farmers. And farmers make up about 80% of the Afghan workforce. And yet we continue to come up with crazy schemes. And part of this has to do with the fact that there are few people left at the U.S. Agency for International Development that know anything about agriculture. So you had a bunch of contractors who were looking at and developing programs that were simply intended to spend money and try to generate some positive short-term headlines, as opposed to people with real dirt under their fingernails helping these farmers improve their lives and reject the insurgency.
So for people who might be sitting here listening to this, Rajiv, and saying, okay, why is cotton such a big deal? Why not just grow cantaloupe or grow pomegranates? The brilliance of cotton for a place like Afghanistan is that it is not perishable after it's harvested.
Exactly. You know, if you remember, Afghanistan, in these rural areas, they don't have good roads. There's no electricity for cold storage. So if you want to grow some fruits, great. Good luck getting those fruits to market so the fruits don't turn into fruit juice by the time you get to the storage facility. Oh, and there's no place to store them, so the fruits will turn stale or will rot unless you can sell them right away. Afghanistan's a landlocked country, so good luck trying to export those quickly to outside markets. Cotton, you can harvest and keep on your farm for a while. You don't have to worry about smooth roads to get it to market. It had so many other benefits that the officials at USAID never fully grasped.
And I suppose they are held accountable mostly according to how much money they spend as opposed to how much good they do with that money.
Yeah, it's this perverse set of incentives. What they measure as a sort of a indicator of success is not how many farmers are growing new crops or how many people have been put back to work. They look at burn rate. How much money are they burning through in a given month?
And they are great at that.
When the burn rate hit $300+ million in 2010 per month, I should note, $300 million taxpayer dollars per month, there was actually celebration at the aid headquarters in Kabul.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is my guest. He's senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post. We're discussing his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Washington Post senior correspondent and associate editor Rajiv Chandrasekaran is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can join us via email to think@kera.org. Rajiv, we haven't talked too much about the State Department in this hour, but it bears discussing that Richard Holbrooke, who was the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, seems to have had serious problems with interpersonal relationships.
Putting it mildly.
I'm waiting for you to elaborate on that, yes.
So he was brought in by Secretary of State Clinton to be the point man for Afghanistan policy, but also to try to chart a path toward possible negotiations with the Taliban. As we were going to send in more troops, that the hope was that some elements of the Taliban would want to perhaps strike a deal with the United States and the Afghan government.
Let me interrupt you for just a second here, because I think a lot of people don't realize that there are sort of more and less extreme members of the Taliban.
Yeah, you can't think of the Taliban as a monolith. Mm-hmm. It's made up of lots of different subgroups, some that are more extreme than others, some that you potentially could sort of cleave away and do a deal with, others who have no desire to do that. And so, yes, it would be wrong to say the insurgency is one unified group. So what you had in 2009 was Richard Holbrooke entering the scene. And he was a guy of vast experience. I mean, he at age 27, he was the youngest American to serve on the U.S. delegation to the Paris peace talks that were aimed at ending the Vietnam War. He brokered the Dayton Accords that ended the war in the Balkans in the mid-90s. He had more experience with war and peace than anybody else at senior ranks of the Obama administration. Problem was, he also had a huge ego, sharp elbows, had a real thirst for the spotlight, and could bully people very frequently, including senior members of President Obama's team. And before long, Holbrooke was in open warfare with senior members of the National Security Council, including National Security Advisor Jim Jones and members of his team. And so instead of working in common purpose to try to chart a path toward the negotiating table, both these sides, Holbrooke and the State Department and the White House team, wound up spending more time fighting one another. And it got incredibly petty. The White House tried to deny him the use of military aircraft to travel to Afghanistan. They'd hold meetings and deliberately exclude him. At one point in the spring of 2010, as I detail in the book, President Karzai was coming to Washington for a meeting with Obama in the Oval Office. And Obama's team tried to exclude Holbrooke from the Oval Office meeting and then slipped the president talking points that said, among other things, everyone in this room represents me and has my trust. The implicit suggestion to Karzai being that Holbrooke did not have the president's trust. It was the scheme was foiled at the last minute when Clinton insisted that Holbrooke attend. But it shows the level to which White House staffers were willing to sort of stoop to try to do in Holbrooke. And, you know, the president could have stepped in here and said, all right, look, either Holbrooke, you're gone. And he could have taken a political hit with Hillary Clinton, who was a big supporter of Holbrooke's, but he could have gotten rid of him. Or he could have told his White House team, look, you may not like Holbrooke, but you got to work with him. We all have to be on the same team. But instead of doing one or the other, he simply allowed these two camps to fight with each other. And it really ultimately hobbled American efforts trying to get a peace deal. And it wound up, you know, wasting a whole year when we had perhaps more leverage in trying to forge a deal than we do today.
How have things changed since Holbrooke died at the end of 2010?
Well, strangely enough, a few weeks after he died, the White House was willing to agree to move forward with an overture to the Taliban to try to get to talks. It hasn't really gotten anywhere, but the White House's willingness to agree to a few steps that Holbrooke had been trying for months to achieve speaks to how, you know, nothing had really changed except for Holbrooke dying, and how once he died, the administration was actually willing to move forward on this.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Theron in Plano. Hi, Theron.
Good afternoon. This whole topic is pretty much hotter in my fixing to go on a Texas bike ride here in the middle of the afternoon. I spent 8.5 years over there as a DOD contractor, and the stuff I ran into over there running around both Afghanistan and Iraq, I could write my own book, but I digress. You mentioned the USAID, and as a member of IEEE, there was an article recently within the last couple of years. You can do a search on a website if you wish, but it mentioned USAID and their total debacleation of their electrification of Afghanistan. Their mountainous areas, the hydroelectric was a perfect choice. But no, USAID, because of their 1 year in the country and out again, decided to go and pursue diesel electrification. I believe that price now is around 50 cents a kilowatt hour for generation of electricity for the Afghans versus what, maybe 5 to 10 cents per with the hydroelectric power. And it really boils down to a lot, not just the USAID, but also the U.S. forces on that one-year tour. They have to go in, get something done, and then by that time, they're going out. And I'll take your comment off the air. But thank you very much for writing that book. I intend to buy it. Trust me.
Thanks for your call. Rajiv, what do you think?
So two great points the caller makes here. One is the one-year tour problem. It's on the civilian side. It's on the military side. Guys come in, women come in, and by the time they start to learn something about the country, it's time to go. New crop comes in. It takes them months to sort of, you know, learn the ropes. more than 80% of the U.S. embassy staff changes over in the summer months. I was just talking to a friend in Kabul who said, ah, Rajiv, it's lobotomy season again here in Kabul. Whole new crop of people coming in who have no clue what the people before them did. Mm-hmm. With electricity, I tell a bit of a story about this in Little America, because we built a dam there in southern Afghanistan in 1963. Back then, it was a symbol of American initiative, a can-do spirit. We built this thing in the upper mountains of Helmand Province, and soon generators were put in, and it was what powered Kandahar and parts of Helmand. Now, it fell into great disrepair. And after 2001, we thought, all right, time to fix it. USAID so screwed up this effort. The worst was a couple of years ago, thousands of British soldiers were mobilized to move a new generator up to the dam. And so these soldiers were pulled away from other assignments. They got the generator up, and then they realized nobody brought up the necessary cement to put the generator in place. And so the generator sits there today, uninstalled. And we've sent in legions of Marines fighting. We've lost dozens of young American men, and countless dozens more have had their legs blown off fighting up along a one-two-lane road that heads up to this dam, so the area can be pacified enough to fix the dam. And it's an incredibly tragic story of a series of American miscalculations over the years that were aimed at, you know, the very noble goal of trying to provide some more electricity to the Afghan people, but failing to do it when it was secure enough and peaceful enough to do it. And so we've been trying to do it in a far more dangerous environment and paying an enormous human cost to fix something that we Americans built back in the Little America days decades ago.
Related to the issue of these one-year tours that are limited in time is the fact that a lot of aid workers in particular sort of live out their time in Afghanistan behind the walls of these heavily secured compounds and don't actually get out and spend much time with the people they're there to serve.
Oh, it's a big problem. A lot of our civilian staff live in these hermetically sealed bubbles. Now, you know, there are a number of brave diplomats and reconstruction workers who want to get out and engage with the Afghans. The problem is the embassy security office has adopted a near zero risk policy. You know, it's a war. You have to take some risks to get some rewards. The military recognizes this. They know that you have to take risks to accomplish your mission. Well, there's a separate standard there for the civilians. Now, I'm not advocating that foreign service officers take the same risks as soldiers. They didn't sign up like people do for the military. But for those who want to go out and do things with the people, they should be allowed to do so instead of being told, that's too dangerous. You can't go out. You can't do this. You can't do that. As one foreign service officer in Kabul told me, and I quote him in the book saying this, the difference in security rules for the civilians, he says, has turned us into women and children on the Titanic.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Rajiv Chandrasekaran about his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. What has changed since the U.S. has moved somewhat away from the counterinsurgency strategy that began with the surge in 2009 and closer to something that looks like counterterrorism?
We've actually started to accomplish a few things. The principal beating back of the Taliban over the past year and a half has largely been a result of more counter-terrorist-type approaches, nighttime raids to kill or capture senior Taliban leaders and financiers and mid-level commanders, and other targeted operations to go after their networks. Less so these efforts to try to rebuild local governments and police forces and protect the population. And so the irony is not lost on a lot of people who were skeptical of counterinsurgency, that the elements of the strategy that they espoused are really what's gained traction. I should note that the counterinsurgency proponents say, oh, those things that we're doing to go after people, that's all part of counterinsurgency. But you know, that's sort of like defining counterinsurgency to include every tool in the military playbook. Now, we're at a point where the military has accomplished some real things on the ground. Security has improved in parts of Afghanistan. When we send in additional forces, things change. And so I want to be very clear to the listeners about that. Those troops have accomplished good things. The real question is how much of it will sustain as our troops start coming home, as our diplomats start coming home. Will the Afghans be able to take up the baton and safeguard the areas that we have cleared of insurgents at a real cost of American lives and limbs? Will the Afghans build the necessary government structures and security force structures to take advantage of what has been achieved? And I think there's a real big question mark. I think we're expecting the Afghans to do far more than they're capable of doing and that they want to do. And so it is a murky future that they face. I don't think the Talibs are going to roll back into Kabul with the same ease as they did in the mid-1990s. But Afghanistan is going to be violent and chaotic for some time to come. And there are going to be pockets of the country that are going to be in the control of the insurgents. There'll be major cities, I think, that will be held by Afghan security forces. And there'll be some fighting for some years to come. Question is, will that be good enough for the United States? There's not a whole lot of al-Qaeda terrorists there. If the Afghans are fighting the insurgency themselves with some American support in terms of equipment and money, is that a decent enough outcome? And I think for many Americans, it probably is. But for me, the enduring question and the one that I try to wrestle with in Little America is, could we have achieved a similar messy but good enough outcome without having to send so many more troops and commit so many more billions of dollars, without losing as many lives and limbs as our fellow Americans in uniform did? And I think we probably could have gotten to a similar place without all of those great costs.
Based on your research, for the foreseeable future, as we continue to invest either in aid or in military assistance, what's the best way to spend that money?
In modest, sustainable ways, not try to flood the country with money. I mean, Afghanistan is very deserving. And please don't interpret my comments as a call to simply wholly disengage from Afghanistan. I think we still have a moral obligation to the Afghan people. You know, we told them back in 2001, if you stand with us against the Taliban, we'll give you a shot at a better, freer life. Afghanistan still is right there at the bottom of all of the global indexes on health. I mean, on infant mortality, on malnutrition, on literacy. It has great needs. And so we in the United States and our allies, I think, still have an obligation to try to help. The question is, can we do so in a way that reduces corruption, that actually gets aid to the Afghan people as opposed to enriching its political leaders and warlords and others? And I'd like to think there are ways to do that, actually at times with lesser money, but focused in on Afghan institutions and on non-governmental groups as opposed to big contractors and other organizations.
The new book by Rajiv Chandrasekaran is called Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think or email think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.